Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, test. Okay, it's working fine. This is an interview with Evelyn, E-V-E-L-Y-N, Bobby, B-O-B-B-I, Trout, T-R-O-U-T, at 7512 Viejo Castilla Way. That's V-I-E-J-O, capital C-A-S-T-I-L-L-A, Way, W-A-Y, at number 18. That's located in Rancho La Costa, capital L-A, capital C-O-S-T-A, in Carlsbad, California, 92008. And our phone number here, Bobby, what is your phone number? It's area code
714-436-6336.
Okay, fine. And we're sitting in Bobby's lovely condominium looking out over the eastern hills with the sun setting in the west. It's November the 3rd, a Thursday, at 4:45 p.m. And Bobby, on short notice, was nice enough to allow 1977 to allow my wife Marie and myself to come and visit her on very short notice. And we're just going to talk about some of the early days in aviation, and I'm going to ask you a very, very personal question. Bobby, can you tell me where and somewhere's when you were born, whatever you want to say?
Well, it was a while back. I was born January the 7th, 1906, in Greenup, Illinois, a little town.
How do you spell it?
G-R-E-E-N-U-P, Greenup, Illinois, about 70 miles west of Terre Haute, Indiana, on the way to St. Louis in there.
I'm just going to set this microphone there, and it'll bother us for a little bit. And then pretty soon, you won't even know it's there.
Oh, that's all right.
Okay. Bobby, where did you go to school at?
Oh, I went to school all over the United States, practically. My dad liked to sort of move around, and my mother wasn't very happy about it. But I went to, about 12, 13 schools, I guess.
How come your father moved around so much?
Well, I don't know. He just, he wasn't, you know, of course, he wasn't a college graduate in those days. You know, most of them weren't. And my mother's father was one of the leading gentlemen of Greenup, Illinois. He had been a doctor, and then he went into the Merchant Company, had a large store there. Then he and the partner had the bank in Greenup, Illinois. And his partner's son stole the money from the bank one day, and my granddad stayed there long enough and paid everybody off. That's how honorable my family was. His father was a doctor too, so it went back to.
What was your father's name?
My father, now that's my grandfather. My father's name was George Trout, and he was not born in Greenup, but his folks, and he lived there, and quite a number of.
What was your mother's name?
My mother's name was Lola Denman, so her father was Dr. Denman.
How do you spell that last name?
D-E-N-M-A-N. And the way that name came about was, in Denmark, they would say, well, there goes a Dane man.
I see. So that's Danish by.
Yes. Now, well, a little Danish there, but then, of course, they went to England. There's a street, I understand, in London named Denman from our family. And as I get it, there were three Denmans came over years ago. One was a preacher, one a doctor, and one a lawyer. And more or less, the children more or less followed those lines for a long time.
Do you remember where you went to high school at?
At high school, I went to Lincoln High School in Los Angeles for a while.
Where's that located?
Lincoln High School over in Lincoln Heights. It's a little bit north of the main part of Los Angeles. And then, you see, my father worked for the telephone company when my mother and my brother and I were in St. Louis. Mother decided she was running a millinery store. Her sister and husband had five millinery stores in St. Louis, and she was running one of them, and we were with her. And she decided that my dad moved around too much, and she wanted us to have an education and stop, you know, moving, so she was going to stay there. But then along came the end of World War I, and of course the influenza attacked us, And it left me with the poor lungs, and the doctor said, you get her to California. Well, of course, my dad was out here, and his folks were here. So my brother and I came out to California to be with them. Of course, we were in Huntington Beach first, and then my grandparents moved down to San Diego. I went to the grammar school in San Diego a short time, and then we went to Chula Vista, where I graduated.
You graduated from grammar school?
Yes. Then I went back to St. Louis. I missed her that following summer, and my dad said, you get your mother to get out of here. Well, my dad was with a telephone company over in Boyle Heights, Hollenbeck Heights. That, you know, once upon a time was the nicest part. Boyle Avenue was the nicest part of L.A., you know. Well, of course, on the east side, you know, as the immigrants and all came, why, of course, they all settled along the east banks of the river. You can call it the L.A. River a river. But anyway, he was with the telephone company there, so that's how come we... were there and finally went into business there because I didn't like high school. I had a terrible time with Spanish. And I said, why don't you let us start a service station, and I'd like to run the service station. So anyway, they're in the foot for them, so we had a service station for years, and I had a wonderful business, and we had people who would wait to get back to Trout's and run out of gas doing so. But we had a very good business.
Where was it located?
At 4th, East 4th and Soto Street.
So
anyway, we were in the service station business for 20 years. However, my mother and I started it, but then it got so good that my dad quit the telephone company.
Remember about what year this was now?
This was around 21. So anyway, right in there, then I was sent back to school. And of course, Roosevelt High School was built about that time. And so then I went to Roosevelt, graduated from Roosevelt High School.
What year did you graduate?
Hold on, I think it was the winter of 26.
Okay.
I was late because, you see, we were in a country on a farm. My grandfather Denman had thousands of acres in Arkansas, so my dad wanted to try farming. So we were down there for about 3 years. And nearly all of us had malaria from the mosquitoes down there, so we had to leave. Then, it was Colorado and here and there.
Okay, now interesting thing comes up.
Yes.
All right, you graduated from high school then when you were 20 years old in 1926.
Six, right.
And Roosevelt High School in Los Angeles.
That's right.
And Roosevelt High School, I can't remember where it is.
It's on East 4th Street.
East 4th Street.
And I don't know if it's Maud or... I don't remember.
Pretty near downtown, though.
Well, it's in the 20.
Side.
It was in the 2000 block, I'd say, on the east side.
Now, when did you learn to fly? I'm going to get back to 1921.
All right, we'll get back into this. Let's see here. I graduated from Roosevelt High School, and I had gone through most of my high school I was going to be an architect, and I was my teacher's right-hand man through architecture. Then I entered USC right after that in the College of Architecture.
About 1927.
It was winter 26 when I graduated, so it was winter 26 when I went over to USC. So several months later, my folks decided to separate. My dad liked to do a little too much running around with my mother. So I quit college to take over the business, run the business, because my brother, you see, is 3 years younger than I am, and he was still in grammar school, still in high school. So I ran that for a year, and then Dad...
That's the Trout service station.
So, and you know, when we started a service station there, we had one of the first radios, you know, that had his master's voice speaker on it, and all the knobs and everything, and they squawked and squeaked. And people would come up and stand on our lot around that service station. It looked like when the TVs first came out and everyone crowded around the windows, you know. Well, that was the way our service station looked.
I want to ask one thing before I get off.
Yes.
Could you tell me how many brothers and sisters you have?
I just have one brother.
And his name is?
Denman Trout.
Denman Trout.
And do you know he has two sons? You know what their names are? One is Lake Trout and one is Brook Trout.
Beautiful.
And Lake is a lawyer now with Loeb & Loeb, the largest firm in Los Angeles, attorneys. And Brooke is with IBM, and they know those two names, and they don't know the president's name.
Beautiful. Okay, now we have you after a year of running the service station. Now you're 23 years old.
All right, now...
Or 21 years old.
Yes. So my mother and dad decided to go back together, and he had gone to Kentucky and spent all of his money on the horses. So came back, in the meantime, then he borrowed money and put up a service station at the corner of Lemon and Chartres in Anaheim. And when he came back and decided, and mother decided she would try it over with him, why... He turned over that service station for my year's work in the station at 4th and Soto. Well, I was down there about a year, but you know, we had Airedales down there. And by that, those are the people who come in and get all the free air and water they can, and they go to their neighbors, and you know, when they have their tanks, they had large orange groves, you know, and they'd get gasoline cheaper and so forth. So the neighbors would get their gas from there, a lot of them. And they'd come and get air and water at our places. So business wasn't as flourishing as I wanted it to. So in a year, I sold out. Got out of there, took a nice trip with friends I'd met down there, who, in fact, the wife and the daughter of Mr. Grant, Hugh Grant was his name. And I think if you look back in the records, he was the one who discovered oil in Huntington Beach. Anyway, the mother and daughter and I took a trip, went up to Vancouver and came back. Now that was about 27. So then I was at a loss. I went back to my folks in Los Angeles and I didn't know just what to do. I thought I was too old to go to school and I should get busy and make money. So I always thought it'd be fun to be a fingerprint expert. Thought it would be very interesting to get into detective work and all. Or, of course, flying. I wanted very badly from the time when I'd go to the theaters and see the planes take off in World War I and all that stuff. And then I was in Canada for a year with one of my mother's aunts up there. And the planes would fly over, the field wasn't far away, and they'd all land, and they just thrilled me to death. So I thought I wanted to fly, but I didn't think that I really should. I thought it was a millionaire's project. So anyway, I'd go out and see about it. So I went out first to see about the fingerprinting business. I couldn't find that school. So then I went down on Western and talked to Mr. Burdett Fuller, and he gave me my first lesson in what made an airplane fly and what happened to the wings and the propeller and so forth. And I signed up for a course in aviation.
Remember what it cost you?
I think it was $250.
You remember how many hours you were supposed to get?
Until I learned to fly. And I don't remember how many hours, but in the meantime, you see why I had... Oh, I'd go out. He had about four or five OX-5 Jennies. And if I'd go out, or I did go out every day, but if one or two of them, you know, was workable, flyable, well, that was great. Because nearly every day, something would go wrong with the valves or something, and so it would have... It'd be worked on, you know. So anyway... a lot of times I'd go out and just have a very little time because of others wanting to fly. But there were a number of women came out to learn to fly, and none of them stayed. I was the only one who finished the course.
Do you remember
there.
Any of their names at all?
No, I don't remember the names.
What year was this now? What
now
month?
This, see, I started, the, I took my, I had my first lesson with Burdett in November or December. I took my physical with Dr. Lister, L-Y-S-T-E-R, and Jones. Lister was on the board of medical examiners and all with the government who set up the physical examinations for the pilots.
What year?
I don't remember what year that was they set it up, but he and Jones gave me my physical license, and of course I took one right on to be a transport pilot.
You took your first lesson in November?
No. That was my on paper with Burdett. But on the 1st of January 1928, I started my flying lesson.
You remember when you got your private?
It was around, I think it was April.
April 1928.
Then I would practice out there, and then when R.O. Boone, who was starting the Golden Nickel Manufacturing Company over in Englewood, came over and saw me flying and wanted me to be his pilot to demonstrate the Golden Eagle aircraft. So, of course, I was glad to get the job, and then it wasn't quite as good looking as the chief, which grew out of that experimental job, which was beautiful and a wonderful airplane. I just loved it.
Which airplane was this?
The Golden Eagle Chief.
The Golden Eagle Chief.
Now, that's the one that they put a Kenner engine in for me to fly in the first Women's Air Derby. And I couldn't win the first trip over to San Bernardino from Santa Monica Airport because the minute I got in the air, my oil pressure dropped right down to nothing. So I circled the city hall, you know, took a little time around about way so I could have a landing field to set down in case I had a broken oil line or so. So I wasn't first over in San Bernardino that night. But anyway, I saw my two gas tanks filled with gas, ran over, went into the dinner, stayed in the hotel all night. Next morning, Thea Rash and I were called late. Why, I don't know. But we rushed out to the airport just in time to find out the route had been changed and what we were to do, and get in our planes and take off, you know, in line. But anyway, I did beat my closest competitor, Phoebe Omley, by 8 minutes over the line at the Imperial Airport down there on the way to Yuma. So I showed you what a good plane I had, because she was a good navigator and all, and a good flyer too, you know. But by golly, I had a much faster plane.
Were you flying alone or some of the...
Alone. Oh, we were all alone.
All alone.
Yeah. No, and I don't think any... I think everyone had to be alone in that derby.
What year was that now?
That was 29.
Okay.
The first women's air derby took off in August 1929. Santa Monica Airport.
That's where I learned to... I got my commercial and whatnot.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
Cloverleaf Aviation.
Who's...
Clover
Aviation. That wasn't Granger's, was it?
No, at that time it was owned by John Hall and Francis Langford and...
Oh, well, what year was that?
Oh, that was 1940.
Oh, yes. Jim Granger had been killed in the 30s. And, of course, Klima is still... she's now in... she's in a restroom, I think, up in Riverside or up in that area somewhere. But, until just the last few years, we were real good friends down at the desert. She's a grand person.
Well, now, you were... how did you get involved? When did you first meet Amelia Earhart, and how did you get involved with the 99s? And one thing I want to bring up. Did you know that Amelia Earhart worked for the telephone company in Los Angeles in 1920-21?
No, I didn't. Yeah.
No. She worked as a clerk downtown.
Well, you know, isn't that interesting? Well, then she was a teacher, too, for a while.
Yes, that was back in Boston.
I see. But when she came to L.A., then she came to L.A. after that?
Yes, in winter of 1928, she flew her Avion across the United States and back to New York again.
What do you know about that?
And do you remember the first time you met her?
I'm trying to think the first time I met Amelia. Well, the first time I met her, my land, was down at around the Santa Monica Airport when we were getting ready to take off on the first Women's Air Derby.
It had been August 1929.
So that was around August 1929, but I don't think I met her before that.
Was she flying her Avion then?
No, she was flying Lockheed then.
She had a Vega then.
She flew a Vega in the race. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Nosed it over in Yuma.
She nosed the Vega over in Yuma?
Yeah.
Are you sure of that? Because I...
Somewhere you'll find that. I think in my scrapbook here, I think we have it.
And she knows the Vega. Was she flying by
but
herself?
But she didn't.
Everybody.
Oh, everybody. Everyone flew with themselves, I'm sure.
All right, so you met her as one of the contestants.
That's right, sure. Oh, and at that time, now, I had quit R.O. Bullen before the race. I had quit him because Louise Thaden... See, early, let me see, when was it? Early in 29, wrote a letter to me and wanted to know if I would go on the first refueling endurance flight for women. That she had a plane, I'm sure D.C. Warren would let us have. And I showed it to my boss, Mr. Bone, and he said, oh, I won't let you go. I don't want to see you killed. No, sirree. Well, you'll kill yourselves, you know. So I wrote and told Louise that I couldn't come as much as I wanted to, and I wanted to badly, because I was all... In the meantime, I'd made my first two solo endurance flights. anyway, the very first part of 29. And on the first flight, I think I established 5 records. Of course, you know, weight lifted and longest night flight for a woman and all sorts of things, you know.
What kind of airplane was that?
That was the little Golden Eagle. We did that in order to advertise the airplane, see. So then the record was broken back in New York, and so then I went back up in, I think it was February, and then stayed 17 hours in something, which broke all records up at that time. So then, Louise wanted me to go on this first refueling flight, and my boss wouldn't let me go, so she didn't go ahead with it. Then, shortly after that, I kept thinking, gee, it's too bad he wouldn't let me do that. Then along came Jack Sherrill from Allman & Associates, who had been the managers of Rudolph Valentino.
Well, how do you spell that last name?
U-L-L-M-A-M, Allman & Associates. And Jack Sherrill was the man who came to me from that organization.
How do you spell Sherrill?
S-H-E-R-R-I-L-L, I think it was. Anyway, he was just, he was precious. Anyway, all the difference in the world in his promoting and working with us, and the fellow who promoted the last refueling flight and went on. But anyway, so I quit Boone to go with him. I said, yes, I'll make a flight. So he said, well, you get someone now to go with you, and I'll get the plane and so forth, and we'll work things out. So when Amelia and the girls were back here, I asked Amelia if she would go on the flight with me. And she said, well, let me think it over, Bobby. I'll see what I can come up with. Well, I think it was the next day or two anyway. She said, Bobby, as much as I'd love to go with you on that flight, I have too much work waiting for me at the end of this, you know, first women's derby back in New York. She was with the Cosmopolitan, and then the latest I recall. She said, I just have too much work waiting for me, and I just won't be able to do it. So then when I got back to Cleveland, why, I asked Eleanor Smith then if she would like to go, and she said yes. So she came out, and we made the first refueling endurance flight for women in the fall, about Thanksgiving time in 1929.
That was where?
That was over at Metropolitan Airport in San Fernando Valley. And
That is now called Burbank Airport.
It's now called Van Nuys.
Van Nuys, okay.
Yes, Van Nuys. Now, we made about 5 attempts before we could finally get the plane rigged and get everything so that we could, get along the air. And Freeman Lang, who used to be master of ceremonies at all of the big movie premieres here in Hollywood, he was in the radio business, and he built a radio for our plane. So I got busy and got my first radio telephone operator's license so that we could send messages back and forth. Well, we put the radio in the back of this plane and went up for a test, and it was so heavy that the stabilizer could not be, pushed enough in order to compensate for the weight. So we had to take the radio out and we'll leave it on the ground. That was very discouraging. So then, of course, we'd use our flashlight at night if we wanted to send messages and stuff. So that was our first refueling endurance flight for women, and that lasted about 42 hours and some minutes. Now, go ahead. Any other questions, or you want me to think about the second?
Okay. I want you to go along. How did you get interested in the 99s?
Oh, well, at the end of the Derby back in Cleveland, now I don't, as I said, I have a poor memory. I don't remember. I wasn't the one that came up with the idea of a women's organization. Someone else did that, and it might have been Amelia. Or Amelia and a group got together thinking we should have an organization. And then a group of us got together and talked about it and decided it should be. So, pardon me. I
just don't want you to have that in your eyes as you
look at
it. Oh,
well, that's all right. So anyway, I know there was a meeting, but where the meeting was, a group of us got together and decided it'd be a great idea. So then, of course, everybody went home, and then we began to get the papers from Amelia about the organization. And so there were 99 of us sent our fees in to belong, and that's how come it was called
the 99. Fee was?
$5, I think.
You weren't at the Valley Stream meeting.
And not that I, that, at that...
You aren't in the picture of the original ones that were at the original meeting then at Valley Stream.
No, I don't know. I don't recall that at all.
Okay. So you, that made you a charter member of the 99s.
Right.
All right. And you remember next thing that you did, or the next time you ran into Amelia or whatever? Or...
She was out here. Let's see, she was out here. What was she out here for? Anyway, a group of us got together. And then... A group of us, I believe she was with us when we went over to Mission Inn one time for a gathering over there. The people who ran the Mission Inn were very aviation-minded,
Remember who they were?
And do you know that I cannot tell you their names? Isn't that awful? But they were lovely, and they just treated flyers as if they were, queens or kings. And they couldn't do enough for the flyers. They gave the section for the plaques and all that sort of thing up there. And there was a very lovely picture taken of Amelia by a light out there. You've seen that at the Mission Inn?
You were there at that time.
But I don't remember whether that was whether that picture was taken when we were all over there together or not. But
now,
anyway.
Did you see Amelia before she got married again? Was she dating anyone out in Los Angeles at all? Or?
When she was out here about that time, I think she was seeing, I tell you, she didn't say much. She was rather quiet when she was with the group. I mean, she didn't do a lot of talking unless it was just something about the meeting or this or that. But as far as going into private life or anything like that, practically nothing. But I am told from friends and all that she was seeing who flew the Phoenix and was killed?
Paul Mans.
Paul Mans. That she was running around a little bit with Paul Mans, I guess. So that was it. And when we would get together, it would be for just a little get-together or a meeting or something, and then she'd go her way and the rest of us would go our way. So. She was not too close to any of the girls with whom I, talked with much.
Did you ever go into any of the Bendix or go back to any of the Cleveland?
No, I was going to go in the second race, and in those days, now this is depression. In those days, it was hard to get a plane. Of course, I had cracked up and gone on my, I went over my back before I got to Yuma because I ran out of gas in the first race, which wasn't, a lot of people didn't know just exactly what happened. So naturally, if I'd won, I'd probably had a lot of planes offered to me. But at this time, there weren't a lot of planes offered. However, a Cessna was offered to me. But it was the day before the race took off, and I couldn't get insurance on it, and I had to have insurance.
I didn't go. What happened on that first race when you cracked up?
The gas that was put in at San Bernardino didn't last until I got to Yuma, just outside of Algodones there. The old engine quit, bang. And here I'm just buzzing along as fast as I'd gained 8 minutes, over Imperial Airport on Phoebe Amelie. And I turned towards Yuma and headed for Yuma, and all of a sudden, it did cough once, and I had a little fright, and then it took hold again. I thought, just a little dirt, So I was going my way, and then the next time, bang, it just stopped. Well, the largest field that looked any good was to the right over in the distance, and I headed for that. It looked like a harrowed, a field that had been plowed and harrowed from the air. And when I got down there, the rows were this way, and I'm headed the other way. It was about 120 degrees in the shade, no shade. So anyway, I tried to mush it in, and then when I tried walking on that field, usually I could, as a kid on the farm, I could step from the top of one furrow to the top of the other. But these furrows right across the border there had been, I think, plowed with the largest plow I believe ever been made. I had to step on the top of the furrow and down on the bottom and on the top and down on the bottom. And that's how large those furrows were. And so you can imagine those little wheels on my Golden Eagle. Well, they were caught and over I went, you know.
So you're lucky you didn't get hurt. So that was your second crack up then?
That was my second crack up. Mm-hmm.
The first one happened at Western Airport. You want to tell me about that again?
Well, that that was, yes, the first one. My assistant instructor was taking me up for forced landings. He pulled a gun, you know, and then you were supposed to pick a spot and sit down. And, of course, Burdett Fuller, my main instructor and the man who owned the field, had said never at a low altitude make any more than a quarter turn in an OX-5 Jenny because they're like streamlined bricks. And the minute you pulled the gun or the throttle, you had to put that nose down.